Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It is Monday, July 14th. A new twist in the saga of the Falls of Clyde, the historic Stillhull ship will not be cut up for scrap, but likely sunk at sea. The Navy's leases for the Pacific Missile Range facility on Kauai's Barking Sands area are soon to expire. A draft environmental impact statement will be the subject of public meetings this week. We hear about a 25-year-old effort to map the health of coral reefs throughout the Pacific, and we take a trip to upcountry Maui for an annual rodeo and ponder the future of the Paniolo. Plus, we turn the spotlight on an impressionist painter whose work is on exhibit now at the Honolulu Museum of Art. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It has been a long and winding journey for a historic vessel whose end is near. The state has just finalized a contract to tow the Falls of Clyde out to sea to be sunk. In the bids that went out last year, Eco Marine won the award but had been leading toward the preferred alternative to cut up the steel-hulled ship at the pier near Aloha Tower. But that company pulled out unexpectedly during a bid challenge, and now a new contractor, Shipwright, is planning to haul the vessel 12 miles offshore. We talked to Ed Sniffen, director of the State Transportation Department, about this latest development in the Falls of Clyde saga that saw it delisted off the historic register in anticipation of it ending up on a scrap heap.
We got through our protest for the award. We awarded to Shipwright LLC to move forward with removal and sinking of the Falls of Clyde. Requirements from EPA is the ship should be sunk at least 12 miles away from shore. So they're looking for a spot now to get approved by EPA to sink this. In the interim, after we give them their notice to proceed on July 21st, that's the date they were shooting for right now, to start moving forward with structurally improving the ship to make sure that it can actually live through the towing for that 12 to 20 mile stretch before they can sink it. So they're going to be upgrading the ship. They're making sure that it's watertight, making sure that they're strengthening a bunch of the outside walls and the hull and everything to ensure that it won't sink either in a harbor or harbor mouth or anywhere between in that voyage, just to make sure it can get to that location, and it'll be sunk there. So we don't know the location yet. We have to get it approved by EPA. Well, once we do, we can get it out to you.
Do we have possible sites?
Generally, EPA just says 12 miles out. We're leaving it up to the contractor to go through the process of getting approvals from EPA. So we cannot say there's definitive sites yet, just locations that we got to be beyond in order for us to fulfill EPA requirements.
So let's step out a bit, because if I recall, some months ago, the plan was to take it apart, have a contractor cut it up on a barge, and then haul it out. So what happened in the meantime?
Yeah, it's an easier process for us to strengthen the ship, to pull it out and sink it. When it's sunk, it provides a sanctuary for fish as well. So there's a benefit to that kind of disposal, and it's one that EPA supports.
But I thought the thinking was EPA was not as keen on sinking things. So what's changed?
I don't know that there was a change. When we started working with EPA and working with our contractor, that was the means of disposal that we had considered for this contract.
So what happened with the protest? Because there was a contractor that won the award, and then we understand that they pulled out.
Yeah, so the contractor that won the award, they won it. They were ready to go in January. They had all their resources set, their heavy lift equipment, their subcontractors, and the support that's required to ensure that they could strengthen the hull. As the process went through, that contractor got busy with other work. So their resources are in other places now. And when we finally got through the processes of the protests, they said they just don't have the resources to get this done in the timeframes. So they've moved on. Since then, we moved on to the number two in our selection, and Shipwright was selected.
No protest?
No protest.
And so has the permit been submitted to the EPA?
I'm not sure that it was submitted yet. We haven't given the contractor the notice to proceed yet. Once we do, that means that we're allowing them to execute the work, and I believe that's when they're going to start working with EPA on this.
Okay, and then what about the plan to remove, you know, any historic items that Friends of the Falls of Clyde, you know, may want to save?
Yeah, so we've removed as much as we could so far. We're storing them in a locked area right now. We're working with the Friends of the Falls of Clyde to see where they all go now. There's some that may be displayed in our Aloha Tower. There's others that could be sent off to another maritime museum in California. We're just kind of working that out with the Friends of Falls of Clyde and the National Park Service right now.
I mean, it is, I believe, the centennial, I think. Is that right? Of the Aloha Tower marketplace?
Coming up. Exactly. Coming up very soon.
Any chance something could be worked up in that time, or is that just too soon?
We're hoping that we can get some of this displayed sooner rather than later. I mean, it's cool stuff. It's historic features that we'd love to put out there. We want to make sure we're following the National Park Service's requirements and working with the Friends of Falls of Clyde so we're not overstepping in those areas.
Okay, so what's the time frame? Because right now we're in hurricane season.
July 21, we'll give them the notice to proceed. By end of November, we should be sinking the ship.
That process, like, do we know how long it take to haul it out?
I think the hauling portion is the short period. What's going to be required in this interim is making sure that we strengthen that ship so it doesn't sink anyplace else but the location that we get approved by EPA. So that's where the contractor will be spending most of their time.
Do we have any indication that it's not seaworthy point?
We are sure it's not seaworthy right now. That's why the contractor is going to be spending the next several months to ensure that everything is watertight. The ship itself, the hulls are strong enough to be able to live through the pulls or the towing so that we'll not sink this anywhere else but the location that EPA allows.
And what's the bottom line on the contract? What's the money figure?
$4.9 million.
What was it with Eco Marine the first go-around?
$6.5 million.
Okay, so this is a cheaper fix.
Yes, cheaper fix for us.
Anything else that you want to say about this process? Because it's been a long haul. It's been many decades and lots of back and forth. So this could come to a close by the end of 2025?
Yeah, we're hoping to get, I mean, with this administration, Governor Green asked us to get things done that's been on the books for a long time. We want to make sure that we finalize things that we're hanging out there. This is a big one. This is a big piece. Making sure that we can remove this ship from this area to ensure the safety and the viability of our ports in this portion here. But also giving closure to the Friends of Falls of Clyde. To their credit, they've been advocating on behalf of this vessel for a long, long time without the resources to be able to move it in the area that they wanted to. So this is the closure that we want to make sure that we give them. But also we want to make sure that we honor the resources that we can remove, or the historic resources that we can remove from the ship in the best ways possible. So we'll work with them. And we really appreciate their support because we've been meeting with them to ensure that when we move forward, we're coordinated with them and they're supportive.
And what happens to the pier where it's docked now? What's the plan for that?
We can start using it for other maritime usage. I mean, that's two piers that's being utilized right now that we could use for other purposes, either for shipbuilding or repair, for loading and unloading. All those pieces open up now with this removed.
Anything else you want to add about Falls of Clyde and this potentially last chapter, last page?
No, we look forward to talking to you on end of November to let you know where we sent it.
All right. Thank you, Ed.
That was Ed Sniffen, State Transportation Director, talking about the latest plan to say aloha to the Falls of Clyde. And under this latest plan, the vessel is to be towed out of Honolulu Harbor and sunk at least 12 miles offshore by the end of the year. Stay tuned for any developments in this saga of this historic ship.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
Marine biologist Jasmine Graham grew up in a fishing family, speaking Creole dialect in South Carolina's Lowcountry. Then she fell in love with sharks.
I was particularly interested in just like the wild and wacky adaptations that sharks have, hammerheads, sawfish, anything that you look at it and you go, why do you look like that?
That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Merriman's Restaurants on Oahu, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Kauai. Details and reservations at merrimanshawaii.com.
You know, this week, a series of community meetings takes place on Kauai. It's to discuss the Navy's draft environmental impact study for continued use of more than 8,000 acres of state land near Barking Sands, which is now home to the military's Pacific Missile Range facility and a NASA observatory. The leases are up in 2030, and the military is looking to continue its operations. This morning, we talked to EIS project manager Carrie Ling about the meetings that kick off tomorrow.
They're going to be live in person, and there's also going to be a virtual call-in option through Zoom. And we've publicized this, and we've advertised it on our website, so you can find the links to the online broadcast portion of these public meetings coming up next week.
And explain to our listeners this piece of the puzzle, because we know the negotiations on the lease will be coming up, but you need this framework, right, these environmental studies leading up to those talks.
Yeah, and so the Navy and NASA, with their federal funding, were able to fund these different surveys. So this EIS does include all updated surveys. We had an archaeological and architectural survey that was completed. We also completed a cultural impact assessment. And that cultural impact assessment takes a look at the cultural practices. And we've talked to the Aha Moku Council here in Kauai about that. So those different pieces of the puzzle help us build our analysis. We look at three different alternatives as well. We looked at six, but if you read the EIS, you'll see that we screened out three of those. And there's reasons for screening those out. The applicants have their screening criteria. So you can learn all about this at the public meetings. We're going to have a 20-minute presentation, and then also going to be subject matter experts there. So you'll be able to walk around and talk to those folks that have specific subject matter expertise. So I think that's kind of an overview. This draft EIS brings into light what the Navy and NASA and the Board of Land and Natural Resources need to go into their real estate negotiations. And those are going to be happening in the next 5 years. So through 2030, that's when these real estate leases and easements expire.
And so then, if you could give us just quick highlights then of those six areas of the study and the three.
Yeah, so the six different alternatives that we originally looked at, not including the Mauka areas, so not including KPGO, Kokea Park Geophysical Observatory, not including Makaha Ridge, because those are conservation districts. So we looked at that, and that was screened out, and you can see why when you read the EIS. I believe it's in Chapter 2, Section 2.2, so you'll have the reason why that was screened out. And then another thing we looked at was we had a comment from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, so we took a look at, during scoping, what would happen if there was a shorter duration of the leases and easements. And that was screened out for further analysis. And then the other thing that we looked at was looking at just renewing the leases and not renewing the easements. So that was also screened out. But the three that were carried forward, those three alternatives were carried for further environmental analysis in our document, the draft EIS. It was under 12 different resources. So you can find all that information in the draft EIS for those three different alternatives.
Can you outline those three alternatives?
So one would be just carrying forth how the lands are currently set up as leases and easements with the Navy and NASA and the state. The second alternative we looked at is the fee simple purchase, so the transfer of some of the leaseholds from the state to the federal government.
So you would buy the fee?
Yeah, so the leases that are currently leased from NASA and Navy, we looked at what would happen if those were transferred over from state to federal. So we took a look at that. So long term, so what would happen if these lands went to the federal government for the long term? And then we also took a look at the no action alternative. So under the no action alternative, keeping in mind this document was written for Navy, NASA, and the Board of Land and Natural Resources. So our no action alternative took a look at what would happen if these lands went back to the state. And so when we look at some of the impacts from that, we're looking at the federal funding. So the current funding that's going on right now for different programs, such as the Natural Resource and Cultural Resource Programs, that would be cut. And so that's a pretty big impact because we don't really have a good idea of how much funding the state has to continue those programs. And so that's why in our draft EIS, you may notice that it says under the no action alternative, under cultural practices, under archaeological and architectural resources, and also under biological resources and public health and safety, that there could, and could being the key word there could be significant adverse impacts. And the reason for that is because of the funding. So the funding that is currently being in place right now from the federal government side was able to do a year's worth of hoary bat surveys, and it was able to do all of these other programs that they have going, and so that would be cut. And we don't have a clear picture of what the state could do for those programs.
Okay, since we're talking about cuts, you know, we're hearing that this administration wants to cut NASA's budget.
Yeah.
Do we have any sense as to how that decision might impact the facility there?
Yeah, and with this draft EIS, we looked at it from the current state of funding. And so where we're at with the funding right now, the draft doesn't analyze that. It looks at where it is with kind of just where the state of everything is right now. And so that funding is still in place. But yeah, that's a really great question, and it's something that this draft EIS, we don't take into account, but it's something that is definitely there. We saw it because of some of the cuts, even with NEPA, which is the national side of this document. So this document is a national, and it's a state of Hawaii document. So on the national side, that's the National Environmental Policy Act, there's been big changes. The environmental justice section, for example, was cut from our document. And additionally, some other things such as page length and things like that are coming into play with the National Environmental Policy Act. But our team thought that it was very key and important to focus on the state document. And so this document is written for the state as they are the accepting authority for this EIS. And so what we did with environmental justice is we were able to take a look at the section we had written, and we were able to pull things from it that went into the other sections of the document. So cultural practices and access, those are two really big topics that people care about. I know that people used to come to PMRF and fish and gather, and there's still that ability. There's different programs that we've actually worked out during scoping. We had a lot of scoping comments come in. That was last year. And it helped us to develop a whole new thing called enhanced management measures. And these enhanced management measures include developing an access management plan that's going to work with the base and also work with the community for easier access to the base, or more streamlined access, I should say, and things like that. There's other enhanced management measures, which I'm going to talk about at the public meetings. So again, encouraging everyone to come to one of the public meetings or to also join us online.
This EIS really addresses a lot of things on land, on the aina, but what are the environmental impacts, let's say, in the ocean, when you might have submarines testing missiles, that kind of thing, in the open waters?
Yeah, and that's a really great question. We took a look at the different projects that are ongoing projects, and they're called cumulative impacts. So the additional impacts from those other projects onto our project. So yes, this project just takes a look and analyzes in the resource section the land-based component. But in the cumulative resource section, we do take a look at the different projects, such as the one that you're talking about, which is the Hawaii-California Testing and Training EIS, and also the Hawaii-Southern California Training and Testing EIS, and overseas EISs. Those two documents have a wealth and plethora of information on what's going on at sea. And so we just take those documents and look at them and how they would, basically the actions that are ongoing at sea, how those would interact with this project and if it adds cumulatively to this project under the resources that we've analyzed.
Will this series of meetings this week address some of those factors at all in the California-Hawaii study?
Yeah, so the Hawaii-California Training and Testing EIS, they had their own public meetings. They happened a few months ago, I think. I can't remember the exact time. But there will be people at the meetings that can talk to folks about what's going on with those projects and how we analyze those in our EIS. But if you read Chapter 6, I believe, of the draft EIS, you'll see the foundational table that lays out all of those different documents that we looked at and projects, and then each resource is analyzed from there with the addition of those projects.
That was Carrie Ling, project manager, talking about a draft EIS and a series of public meetings that start tomorrow on Kauai. The Navy presentation will include Captain Robert Prince, the new commanding officer of the installation. He'll talk about how the testing and development of high-tech weapons is tied to what's playing out in hotspots across the globe, including the recent attacks of Houthi rebels on U.S.-flagged commercial ships in the Red Sea. We'll have links to the schedule for this week's meetings on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the distance learning executive MBA and Master of HR Management. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu/executive.
I'm Marco Werman. The World's Newsroom brings you the big picture stories and some other stuff.
It may surprise you to learn, but in Italy, many, many mafiosi are religious.
You don't expect to find a swimming pool in the middle of the desert.
The rule number one when planning a golf course in China is to not call it a golf course.
Join us and hear the world.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the University of Hawaii Foundation. Its 4UH for Hawaii campaign connects donors with UH to fuel innovation and entrepreneurship across the islands. UHFoundation.org.
A massive annual survey of coral reefs throughout the Pacific Ocean just wrapped up. Scientists from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, or NOAA, have returned from a four-month voyage where they charted the growth and decline of coral reefs, 1 millimeter at a time. Tom Oliver took part in the annual survey. He stopped by our studios to speak with the Conversations D.W. Gibson about the trove of data that was collected this year, beginning with the NOAA initiative to map our ocean's reefs.
So the National Coral Reef Monitoring Program, it's a national program monitoring the U.S. coral reef ecosystems. It's been active since about the year 2000 when it was passed into law. And what it really is a survey that goes out to measure really all of the aspects of the coral reef ecosystem across the U.S. Pacific. It is really a national gold standard for these kinds of monitoring programs, and it's recognized by international partners. What makes it interesting and unique is on some level the scale that we cover, and for the fact that we managed to take all these different angles on the ecosystem, looking at fishes, corals, the drivers of change in these systems, like carbonate and warming and acidification, as well as coupling this with human dimension surveys. So we go out and look at the biophysical aspects of it, but colleagues of ours also follow up with the communities nearby all these reefs where we work.
So you go out into the reefs to do all of this monitoring. Tell us what that looks like.
Yeah, so we cover a huge area, so including the whole Hawaiian archipelago, the Marianas Archipelago, all of these small islands in the middle called the Pacific Remote Island Areas, and then American Samoa. And in order to cover these areas, including some of the most remote reefs in the world, we get onto a big NOAA white ship. So that's a big survey vessel. It's 224 feet long. And that's our mothership and home for many months. These surveys last 4 months usually. So we'll get on, and then that mothership launches these small boats where we put a team of maybe five people that go out and basically do scuba dive surveys many times a day. What I'm talking about today, what we just finished up, was our Marianas cruise. So that's Guam, Saipan, and the whole Marianas Archipelago. And then in 26, we'll be in the Pacific Remote Island Areas and American Samoa. And then we do it all over again.
It's so hard to wrap one's mind around the areas you're listing off, the different archipelagos and different sort of sections of the Pacific.
Right.
Do you have any tricks for getting people to be able to comprehend the sheer size of the areas you're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, I'll say Google Earth is an amazing tool. And I love if you just spin the globe till you're looking at nothing but water. Most of the expanse you're going to see on that screen is covered in our survey domain, right? So if you put Hawaii in the upper right-hand corner, Indonesia's just creeping in on the left. And just about everything east to west in there has islands that we survey in. And it goes, you know, well south of the equator down to 14 degrees south.
Talk about how the work you do has changed over the last several years in terms of tools available to you.
Yeah. So, I mean, some of it has not changed that much, right? Because this is long-term monitoring. We've been trying to keep a through line of data that's referential to itself since 2000, which is now 25 years ago, right? And so in that 25 years, we really started with put humans underwater with clipboards. They see things, they write them down in a structured way, and then they come back and that's our data. And we still do that for our fish surveys, right? So we send divers down and they record stuff. Increasingly, especially over the last 5 years or so, we've transitioned for our coral and other benthic. Benthic just means the bottom of the ocean. Our benthic survey has moved to imaging techniques. So we, instead of going down with clipboards and saying, hey, I've counted three corals, we get on with a camera and we'll take a few thousand photos at a site. And then once we get back out of the water, reconstruct those photos into a three-dimensional model of the reef. It's called photogrammetry. And photogrammetry has been a really revolutionizing tool in our quiver. And we've had to do all the work to make sure it does line up in the same way that our old data did. But now it's great because it basically lets us collect a lot more data a lot more rapidly while we're in the field, because, you know, doing this field work is hard and expensive. But it also means that we freeze that reef in time and we can collect all sorts of information from it when we get back to Honolulu from that model of it. We're talking about millimeter scale, very fine scale data. And we can even more than that, take those pictures in the same exact places. Every third year we go around and do this, we can stack those up and actually track change, like track individual corals. It's as if you went out in your garden and you took a picture of your garden every few months. You could track that carrot plant getting bigger and bigger. We do that for wild corals now with this imaging technique.
I have to say there's some poetics buried in the fact that you are covering such large swaths of ocean and zooming in on such fine details.
You need to zoom in to get the fine details and to cover that whole area. That's statistics, man. You go out and you just do enough sites spread effectively well across this area. If you want to study the life and death of corals in particular, you got to watch them come in, watch them settle, watch them recruit. And when they recruit, a coral colony is millimeters across, right? So we need that accuracy if we're going to say, ah, okay, these guys start at that size and they grow up through these patterns. Yeah.
Well, so looking at those details, what trends have you and your colleagues been able to see in terms of the health of coral reefs in the Pacific since the work began in the early 2000s?
Yeah, it's another zoom in, zoom out answer. Really, when you zoom out and you start looking at things at a regional scale, what we see is often a story of decline. And I think it's a story that has crept through in the public messaging. When people, as a coral reef biologist, when I walk around and tell people at a party that I'm a coral reef biologist, often the answer that I get is, oh man, that must be hard. But what's interesting is when you do zoom in, that it's actually much more of a mosaic. There are some areas that have been really significantly impacted by especially climate forces, like with bleaching and whatnot. But there are other areas that are actually still doing quite well in the face of serious challenge. And it breaks down to about maybe 30 to 35% of the areas that we follow are seeing some significant disturbance or significant decline. But something on the order of 40 to 45% of them that we're following, if we just look at what's happening in the coral populations, are holding steady at high cover or are increasing, right? So it is this mosaic, and a huge part of our job is to try to understand what sets these things apart and how that can inform management. Like, how can we do what we can to make most of the area look like the happy side of that mosaic?
What do you do with all of that data once you get it? Who are the stakeholders you need to share it with?
The monitoring effort exists to better inform management about coral reefs. And so what does management mean? That's a whole range of partners. Some of those folks are in our own shop, right? So NOAA and NOAA Fisheries have a lot of management they do, from protected species work to other forms of fisheries management. We also are paired with and do a lot of advice to the Western Pacific Fisheries Management Council, because our data sets are some of the best data sets available for coral reef fisheries in particular. Then we also work very closely with state and regional partners. So the equivalent here in Hawaii would be the part of DLNR that is the Department of Aquatic Resources, DAR. And so the DAR equivalents in Guam and the Commonwealth of Northern Mariana, CNMI, and American Samoa are strong partners for us. And we also, as a federal entity, end up advising a bunch of other federal entities, so from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, that also does a whole lot of protected species work, to the sanctuary system, right? There are sanctuaries here in Hawaii and in American Samoa. We work with them quite a bit. We do interact with the Department of Defense a fair amount. Like, a lot of the areas in the Central Pacific actually are Department of Defense stations. And so we have a number of institutional partners that are reliant on both our data, but more so even the advice of the folks who are working in our shop, who are very close to the data and understand it. And again, really coming back to that question of what we call differential resilience. So, like, why is that place doing better than that place? And how can we work to improve conditions to get them all to look as good as they can?
Well, and I would imagine there is a process now that you're done with the actual survey work for this year. So what does that timeline look like in terms of when you learn about what you saw this year?
It's different for the different data sets, really. So, like, we talk about the fish data, you're just writing it on a clipboard. That data, as soon as the two fish divers come up that evening, they're going to sit down next to each other and just go through, oh, did you see those guys? Oh, I saw those guys. Yeah, did you see, like, basically check to make sure that their data makes sense to each other. And then at that point, it's digitized and that's pretty available. We still have a few months of just sort of final checks that we do back here. But for the imaging data especially, we're just entering the phase of modeling and annotation. So we take all of those many thousands of images, and we're talking every season we're collecting on the order of 10 terabytes of imagery, and we model that and then we start annotating that. So you basically simulate diving the site and you go in and you take the measurements in the structured way that we take them. Generally, we try to have our data available, generated, and then quality controlled, and then posted so that it's publicly shareable within a year of collection. And we have a portal where you can explore, look through all of these, all the data that we're collecting. You can explore it and even download our entire data sets going back over a decade.
Well, AI is something that is on everyone's minds these days. I have to imagine it plays a role in the process of looking at the data that you're getting.
Yeah, increasingly it does. We've had some versions of, like, early machine learning AI, you know, going back as far as 2015, so nearly a decade now. But as we've moved to this photogrammetry model, we're increasingly building AI tools to really support the humans that are doing the inference, right? That we're very strong about what's called human in the loop AI. And we have very specific AI tools that are there to basically support a human who never leaves the loop, right? Because we really want the highest standard of data coming out of this and making sure that we get to use our humans for the thoughtful, ecological-minded analysis that they can do, not for what can end up being tedious work. I mean, as a scientist, there's a big difference between boredom and tedium, right? And, like, scientific work that can be very important and very exciting can be very tedious. And so using those AI tools to sort of help even out that tedium but still keep the human generating and sort of driving the bus is where we go for that.
You know, obviously science is the reason why you're doing this. But take a minute, please, and talk about just the experience of spending time in these areas, these remote areas where you are seeing such remote places in the world. What is that experience like?
Incredibly rewarding and humbling is what I constantly keep coming back to. The ship that we get onto is motoring thousands of miles to get us where we're going. And we end up going to places that, honestly, very few other people get a chance to see. And that's both personally and scientifically important. It's scientifically important because it's a great control, but also to be there and to see those changes and those different responses, and just to know that we are lucky enough to get to go here and absorb the lessons and the sort of duty that that implies on us is the humbling part. We're very lucky, but it is absolutely on us because we have the opportunity to do that, to carry the kuleana of that place, right? That like it's our job to come back and tell people our observations and describe what's happening in these wild places and what lessons we can learn from them.
That was Tom Oliver, a scientist with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association. Oliver spoke with HPR's G.W. Gibson about the past 25 years of tracking fish and coral reef health throughout the Pacific. For links to the data he referenced and pictures of the NOAA vessel out at sea, check out our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
To be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade.
July's a big month for the cowboy world. HPR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel was fortunate enough to attend a rodeo, not on the Big Island where we've had our focus recently, but on Maui. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
I'm jealous. You got to go be around horses.
It was fun. The 4th of July Makawao Stampede is a huge event on Maui. It's actually a whole week long, starting with a Makawao parade and pretty much celebrating the Paniolo culture all week long. The rodeo itself goes Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And it is Hawaii's largest rodeo. There were so many people there. The bull bash on Friday night was sold out, and I think there are around 6,000 people there. And then there were thousands on Saturday and Sunday. I was there on Saturday. And it is just, you know, such a rich, loud, hot, dusty, fun event. There's steer wrestling in which two cowboys will ride horses along next to each other with the steer running between them. One of the cowboys has to jump at a full gallop onto the back of the steer and wrestle it to the ground. There's bull riding. There's lots of keiki events. There's an event called mutton busting in which a keiki gets all decked out in protective gear and jumps on the back of a sheep and has to ride as long as they can on the back of that sheep while they're running top speed across the arena. There is Pole Waiū, which is actually an event unique to Hawaii, and it was created in part by Maura Miranda's dad. Maura Miranda is a fifth generation cowgirl who is continuing to steward her family's ranch in Makawao. They hosted the 4th of July Stampede, and Pole Waiū is an event in which kind of mimicking real, you know, wild cattle roping. The cowboy has to, or cowgirl, it's for both, tie the steer around a pole that sort of is meant to mimic a tree in the middle of the arena. And that's a really, you know, iconic Hawaii event. So just a whole variety. It's hot, it's dusty, it's loud. The crowd is just going wild. Let's take a listen.
All right, this is going to be our last bow racer in this section of the junior bow racing. Now, 24:36 in the first go. Look here. Gets around another good pocket around number two. Look out. We got something going here. Hopper, Makawao, Hopper. Hey, Rob. She's got to be quicker than a 22.90 to take the lead. 21.64, we took the lead.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Really puts us there in the moment, you know? I mean, I can feel the dust in my mouth.
Absolutely. It's just, you know, it's wild. It's fun. And what struck me throughout the event was just like the risk involved. I mean, of course, they take all the safety precautions, but the skill involved just to stay safe, you know, on these bucking bulls and wild bronco horses. They do bronco riding. Even the steer wrestling event, you know, they're in the dust with, you know, just like rolling around with these cattle. I mean, it's wild. It's really cool to watch. And Paniolo traditions, you know, have a long history in Hawaii. And one of the questions is, you know, like, will that culture be continued on, right? Like, it's used to be such a rough lifestyle listening to the stories of these old Paniolo from, you know, years ago till today, you know, it is being carried on, but will it continue? What does it take to carry it on? You know, some people say it is a dying tradition, but Maura Miranda sees it as still going strong. Here she talks about it.
We've got to create a space for them to come and try and learn, because we need more cowboys. And I think it's growing. I absolutely believe culture is changing. It's not wild like it used to be. Culturally, it's more attractive, and families and kids are being drawn back into the Paniolo ranching lifestyle. I grew up where a good time Saturday night, usually a good old barroom brawl and a lot of carousing and things going on that I wouldn't want to have my kids be around at all. And I feel like we've helped change the culture of the rodeo environment here on Maui, where it is a place you want to take your kids. And there are people that they can look up to and say, I would like to be like them someday.
Yeah, important traditions.
Absolutely. And Maura and her husband, Ken Miranda, their whole Ohana and their whole team, you know, this is really a community event that's made possible by a huge group of people. But, you know, she talked about prioritizing it as a family friendly and a safe event. You know, she said they want to make sure that when families come, you know, Keiki can be walking through the rodeo by themselves. You know, there's games, there's activities, there's food, there's music, you know, there's a lot outside the rodeo itself. And she wants to make sure that it's a place where, you know, Keiki can be safe walking by themselves, and they will be taken care of and looked after by the entire community at the rodeo. And I think they really did achieve that. You know, they have a long family tradition in their families of rodeo. Maura's great-grandfather bought the ranch in 1916, and the arena is actually named after her grandfather, Oski Rice. There's a whole history there that was really cool to listen to, but it is really nice to see it being carried on. Maura and Ken's daughter, Elizabeth Miranda, just graduated from high school, and she actually won the all-around cowgirl title from the weekend. And she is currently one of the Maui youth competing at the National High School Finals Rodeo in Wyoming this week. So I think it just started yesterday. I haven't seen any results come out yet, but there's a whole group of Maui young cowboys and cowgirls there representing at Nationals this week. So we wish them luck. And yeah, just, you know, all around a really sort of iconic upcountry event celebrating Paniolo culture, and amazing for spectators and competitors alike. There were over 250 competitors from across the country and spectators from around the world. So it's really, you know, a unique event to bring to upcountry Maui.
Well, we hope that they can continue, you know, but it takes a lot to put on a program like this.
So it absolutely does take a lot to plan this event. Maura said they've already started planning for next year. As soon as this event ended, they were back to planning. So much goes into it. Maura Miranda here talks about the thought that they put into that planning.
We really thoughtfully and purposefully plan out the spectator experience. And we do the same for our cowboys. We had over $25,000 in added money and prizes for the cowboys. On top of that, Ken came up with, to support our local cowboys, a $1,000 Paniolo bonus, he called it. And that was if a Hawaii resident won the bull riding, saddle bronc, or bareback bronc riding, they won an additional $1,000 to their winnings. So I think what separates us is our community-mindedness and being very purposeful and thoughtful about our spectator experience and our cowboy competitors' experience.
Yeah, it's a great story. But thank you so much for sharing it with our audience.
It was a blast. Thanks so much.
All right. We've been hearing from HPR's Catherine Kloepachtel.
Let's have a hand for that young cowboy and wish him better luck next time. I hope we see him up in Fargo.
Support for HPR comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for the HTDC Entrepreneur Sandbox in Kaka'ako, committed to design that serves and celebrates the environment, culture, and community. FerraroChoi.com.
Today on The Daily, a rural doctor walks through exactly what will happen to her patients with the rollback of Medicaid under Republicans' sweeping new domestic policy law. I'm Natalie Kitroev. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30, following Marketplace.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Today, France marks Bastille Day, which is actually the start of the French Revolution. And today, we feature an artist who was part of the French Impressionist movement. HPR's culture and arts reporter, Cassie Ordonio, is here to talk about Mary Cassatt. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I understand that what sets her apart is, one, she's a woman, and two, she's American and not French.
Exactly. She's actually originally from Pennsylvania, born and raised, but then she also spent a lot of her life in Philadelphia before she spent the rest of her early 20s in France. So she is born into an upper middle class family. She took a different route because her father wanted her to kind of be a childbearer and get married, live the typical woman life that was kind of depicted back in like the late 1800s, early 1900s. But she was like, no, I'm going to be an artist. And so she actually, she was an impressionist. She was the only American to exhibit her works with the French impressionists, and she was only one of three women, so it was a very male-dominated field. But her work actually takes more of like a radical approach to artworks. She was a painter, a pastelist, she did etching, and she was also a printmaker. A lot of people didn't really know that she was a printmaker during that time. So she was kind of navigating that field of a male-dominated field, but her work is centered around literally women at work, which is the title of the exhibit at the Honolulu Museum of Art. So when you look at her work in the exhibit, it's very women-focused. Her paintings kind of have this very detailed, centric look into the woman's face, the softness of their face. But in the background, because of her style of painting, kind of has like this movement where it's kind of like, it looks like squiggly lines in the background, but there you get a sense of like, this woman is outdoors, or this woman is in like a theatrical setting. So that was kind of the mystery behind it, but you still get a glimpse of what that woman is like in that artwork. And so I spoke with Alejandra Rojas Silva. She is HOMA's curator of European and American art. And she says this project is to spotlight Mary Cassatt. It started in the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Two curators there, they wanted to reframe Mary Cassatt's art and focus on her attention to her work and the perception of her as an artist. And so far, the exhibit, Mary Cassatt at Work, has been in Philadelphia, San Francisco, and now Hawaii on Oahu. So Silva talks about what it might have been like for Mary Cassatt having to navigate a male-dominated field in the field of Impressionism.
It would have been somewhat difficult, but she was very committed. Although she was showing with other Impressionists, she had certain restrictions. She came from a well-to-do family, and there were some expectations that came with that. So she couldn't navigate the whole of Parisian social life. She couldn't, as some of the other Impressionists do, go into bars or parks. She was more restricted. And what she did was still show us a vision of modern life and what it meant to be both an employee or a wealthy woman in Paris and navigate those spaces in a time of really intense social change. It was difficult for her to navigate that. I think her father and her mother were expecting her to marry, and she was very adamant that she really would not do so. At some point, her father really pushed her to have her studio, her materials, her models pay for themselves. So he kind of decided, I'm not giving you any more money for this hobby that you have. But really, she very quickly became economically successful.
Yeah, I'm interested in learning more about her because I love Impressionism.
And she's a very savvy businesswoman, too. But going back to Impressionism, this style of art actually originated in France in the 19th century. And it's characterized by paintings of daily life and landscapes that are done on the spot, outdoors rather than a studio. So that's kind of like more of like a non-traditional setting back then. And Mary Cassatt, you know, during her time, Silva described her artwork as radical because it was a different time back then. Back then, women weren't allowed to go to the bars or parks by themselves. But Mary Cassatt wanted to depict women literally at work doing tasks such as childcare, embroidery, or even driving. There's a painting in there, it was actually depicted of her sister driving with a young girl. And then in the painting, you could see a man kind of taking the back seat. So that was very interesting. But what's also interesting about this exhibit, Silva said that Mary Cassatt actually drew inspiration from Japanese art, specifically ukiyo-e. It's an art style that flourished during the Edo period, and it involves carving into a woodblock, putting it in ink, and then transferring it onto a flat surface like a fabric or paper. And Cassatt was so inspired by the artwork, the Japanese artwork that she saw in Paris, that she bought the prints and produced a series in 1891, so the following year after she saw it. And then she tried to replicate that art style and make it into her own. So when she took the wood blocks, she actually started to kind of make up her own artwork. So instead of using wood blocks, she actually used copper plates. Mm. And then she started etching using this hot needle to kind of trace the figures of like the woman, the letter that's at the Honolulu Museum of Art. And then she really did kind of make it more of like a westernized concept of printmaking.
Well, and these prints, I understand that Honma has the largest collection.
Yeah, Homa actually has the largest collection of Japanese prints in the United States, that's according to Silva, and they have more than 12,000 pieces in its collection. So the exhibit Mary Cassatt at Work has 35 pieces on display. Most of them are loaned from Philadelphia Museum of Art, and Homa acquired 8. But you'll also see Homa's personal collection of Japanese art, which consists of 5 pieces of work.
Okay, and that exhibit's up till October, right?
Yeah, October 12th.
All right, great. Well, can't wait to see it. But thanks so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HPR's Cassie Ordonio about the new Mary Cassatt exhibit at the Honolulu Museum of Art. Mary Cassatt at Work will be on view through the 12th of October. Well, we're out of time, but tomorrow we plan to hear from a ballerina back home in the islands to inspire young dancers. Have a story idea to share with us? Call our Talk Back line at 808-792-8217 or email us on our website. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.